Hi, this is John Pizzoni, and you are listening to Rock Paper Podcast with Chris and Shane.
Rock Paper Podcast. Rock Paper Podcast. Rock Paper Podcast, y'all.
Welcome to Rock Paper Podcast, episode 63. My name is Chris Bemuter.
I'm Shane Presley.
First, want to say thank you to Vintage Vital for a great, awesome record store day. We went out there. Got to guest DJ, hung out. It was a blast. It was the first time I had been down there, and I was just like, the Loop is such a cool place to be, and that day especially was like just such a fun time. And I just want to say thanks because that was a good time. Yeah. Those guys at Vintage Vinyl are awesome.
Thanks Jim, and everybody down there. It was cool to be included.
It's a good time.
We even played Unurged Tune down there. So
nice.
So speaking of, we have John Pizzoni. Who is that?
That was one of the guys from School of Rock.
Oh, yeah. Okay, gotcha. I figured that's what it was.
I saw him.
They're down at
Friday night. Was that Saturday night?
I was just there a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, so Saturday night they played with a Funky Butt Brass Band. They got to open up for them at Old Rock House, and I was there. And I saw him sing, and so I ran into him here, and so it was. So that's what he was saying.
Gotcha. I just saw a random kid. And hey, what's up? So we got John Pizzoni on here this week from The Urge and a thousand other bands.
Yeah,
I think you're incredibly busy. So thanks for coming out and hanging out. We're outside of a Breadco, which is kind of like our staple now. I think we've done a few shows outside of a Breadco. Yeah. But
I like it. We're outside.
It's a nice environment.
57 degrees out. It's quite nice.
It's not
a little chilly. It's
so
great.
It's nice. So thanks for coming on and hanging out.
Thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to it. Yeah.
So we were kind of talking, and you kind of had me hook as soon as we mentioned hockey. So really, this whole podcast is going to be an hour long talking about why we're
I'd be okay with that.
Yeah.
I can do it. I've debated doing a hockey podcast. So.
If you do, let me know and I'll totally jump in on that. It'd be awesome. So, thanks for coming on and hanging out. Now, have you been to a record store day? Have you ever gone down on
this? No, and I don't think so. I mean, if I did, I wasn't aware of it because I've done, we've done lots of stuff at Vintage and I've known Jim for years. And actually, my sister-in-law now is his cousin, which is quite funny. She's an Utz,
There you go.
But my in-law, my brother-in-law's, my wife's brother's wife, but whatever. But that's neither here nor there. But but I've known Jim for years, so I'm trying to think. We might have done something like that at one point.
It was the first time I'd ever been, but it was a blast. I've gone down the Loop a few times. I haven't done there too often, but it's just such a cool, cultural vibe. But going down there on that day, it's just everybody's down there for that purpose and just seeing everybody.
The fact that there's still actually a record store that sells records is pretty impressive in itself.
It's kind of nice, too, because, and this is not to in any way put down Vintage Vinyl, but it's kind of like a grungy little place, which is awesome.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
because if it was a super, a modern-looking place, I think it would lose the amazing vibe.
Oh, for sure,
vibe.
Yeah. It's supposed to feel like an old record store.
Yeah, I liked it.
You can't, just that smell when you walk in the door of old vinyl, there's a lot of that.
There's that whole charm that's been missed of the stack of vinyl records and leafing, going through the used section and leafing through and then finding the one. Oh my God, I found the one I was looking for. I can't believe it's in here.
Now, do you collect any vinyl or do you?
I don't really collect. I still have a bunch.
Yeah.
And I will if I come across one that I want, I'll get it because, I know I listen to Bill Ryder's podcast that you guys did. And like I said, we have the studio in my basement. So one of the things I like to have for vibe is the right records up on the wall.
Oh, right, yeah.
So I have several records that are framed. And it's they're real sort of juxtaposed, but it's they're all undeniable records. Obviously I have Sgt. Pepper, but then I have Fleetwood Mac Rumors.
Yeah. Right.
Because it's Rumors.
Yeah.
It's sold almost as many records as anything else. But then there's Jimi Hendrix, Axis Bold as Love, and I got the Police, Outlandos D'Amore up there. So it's there's just different. That's my favorite thing is to get a record. I'm not even going to listen to this. It's going on the wall.
You buy it for the almost kind of showcase and be this is beautiful, beautiful. Artwork.
It is, but and that's another thing that's lost was when you used to get them and used to the ones that were double fold and you'd look at the band pictures and you'd read all the credits and then you'd open it up and there'd be more pictures on the record sleeve.
Yeah.
And I would look at who produced it and all that. I did all that stuff when I was a kid.
Yeah, it's definitely the whole idea of even with CDs, it seems like it's getting a lot more limited to where there's not a booklet or a thing.
Costs money.
It
costs so much money.
It just seems like that's the case with all sorts of video games and everything. I used to remember getting a game and just looking through the booklet. Now it's here's one page and it's got
You don't even get an instruction booklet anymore.
Right.
You learn how to play it while you're playing it. Yeah. It's I don't know how to play this.
Yeah, you get online and then people are just hey, we're new, why don't you go out there and teach them out? Awesome.
There's 8 buttons on here. I can't figure this out.
I don't even have this many fingers. What the hell? Jeez. So talking about the record store, you got that in your house, right?
Yes.
So how does... I guess, like, because I think that would be so rad to have. Like, how do you kind of make that decision to say, I'm going to kind of go forward?
Cause I'm going to give a ton of credit to my wife.
Yeah.
So my wife and I lived in South City right when we got married. It's a very small little house, a little two-bedroom house, which was perfect for us. It was great. We were right off of Hampton. It was awesome. And so I had a whole unfinished basement to myself, which was a quasi-studio. I had a little Pro Tools rig that we bought. Actually, that The Urge bought back in 2001 or 2000 when we were going to make our own record, which we did and never finished it. We recorded, like, music for about 20 songs, and none of them ever got finished. Steve had moved to L.A., and it was just kind of that's it, we're done. And we just sort of split up, and we just never did it. So when we started getting back together, a lot of the guys wanted to revisit that stuff. I'm like, let's... We did that. I like the music that we're writing to be a moment in time, where you are now at this point in your life. But some of it's really good. We should revisit it. But anyway, so I had like a little bit of a recording rig. And then my wife, who loves to go to like estate sales and stuff, found the house that we're in, which is total suburbia. It's in a little... I'm actually back where I grew up. I grew up in Afton.
Oh, okay.
And technically I'm in Afton, but it's a little neighborhood called Lakeshire with its own little police force and all that stuff. You know, like there's three cops or whatever there is, you know.
Yeah.
But it's real nice and suburban. It's a huge yard. It's just a ranch, but it's got a huge yard.
Yeah.
I showed up and I was like, I remember thinking, I'm like, this is like a grown-up house. I'm not a grown-up. Like, this is bigger than the house I grew up in. We can't afford this house.
Yeah.
But back, we bought it in 06, you could.
Oh,
you
right,
know?
Yeah.
And I was like, well, I'm not cutting this lawn, you know. But right off the bat, my wife, when she saw it, was like, you could build a studio here. You could totally build a studio here. And so between my wife and my in-laws being as cool as they are, and my parents too, don't get me wrong, but my in-laws specifically helped me, like, money-wise. Mm-hmm. And my mother-in-law's brother-in-law, so whatever, uncle on my wife's side is a retired contractor.
Okay.
So he's like, well, I'll help you build everything.
Yeah.
So it was basically me and him and my father-in-law and my dad doing all the work. And then it was just sort of like, we built the frame of it, then I had to do everything. So, I mean, I went and I bought like a big board, you know, an old recording console, and I built a little ISO booth to do vocals in, and just sort of made it happen. And then kind of had some antiquated gear. And then when The Urge decided to make the last record, you know, I kind of thought, well, when we do the pageant shows, I could probably buy with the newer version of Pro Tools. You basically buy the newer Pro Tools, any kind of, I don't want to get techno dork here, but any kind of recording interface will work with it, and a good Mac. And that's all you needed.
Right.
So we bought like an 8-core Mac, and that was it. And so the Urge spent money on the rig, and now I've got, you know, I haven't changed a thing since. That was 3-4 years ago. It's pretty awesome. Yeah. And now, you know, we're just set up to where we're writing now. Like, in fact, the guys are coming over, it's tomorrow, Thursday night.
Okay.
And I just have a few mics up, got guitar rigs, you know, guitar amp ready to go, bass amp ready to go. Mics for horns. Bill's got a little keyboard set up, and we just come up with jams. And it's but like you said, that what's weird about it is, for me, is I like to do stuff by myself, being kind of a multi-instrumentalist, if you will.
Yeah.
So when I'm killing time, I'll record like cover versions of songs that I like, just to do it.
That'd
just
awesome.
As like an exercise almost.
Yeah.
Like I'll listen to a song I really like and go, how did they get that drum sound? You know, and try to emulate it and go, okay, and I'll write it down. Like, well, here's what I did. I used this microphone, and so that's. I have it there at my disposal. I don't do enough work in it.
Yeah.
That's the problem. I spend way too much time, like we just said, playing video games. I'm up at 1 in the morning until I almost fall asleep.
That's
you know?
All right. Well, and
that's just the way I've always been.
Did you learn kind of recording stuff just from over the years, you know, being around it?
Yeah, pretty much. Okay. I've never had a formal lesson in anything, really. Mm-hmm. You know, it's all been pick it up as I go. But, I mean, literally from the time I was in the first band, that interested me.
Yeah.
Because in my first band in high school, actually, like I said, you also did a podcast with Jerry Jost. Jerry and I have been in bands together since we were 14 years old. Like, right. We were in our first band together in high school. And we eventually bought all of our own PA. Well, you had to set it up and run it yourself. Well, I just sort of took it upon myself to learn that side of it. And then when we would practice, I would always just take, like, even a tape deck and just record the practice.
Oh, okay.
Like, run microphones to the board and just use the headphones. And what do you do with the bass drum to make it sound better?
Yeah.
I wasn't good at it, but that's how I learned.
Yeah.
And then after that, it would be like Jerry's, when his little brother was in his first band. He's not really a little brother anymore, but when he's 6 years younger, when you're 18 and he's 12, you know, that's a lot.
Yeah.
And then they're like first band, you know, and they're like, can you record us? And so I would do it. I just like a 4-track. I just kind of learned as I went. And I'm always still learning, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not like an audiologist. I don't know anything really about the science of it. I just listen to my ears, you know, so.
Yeah. Well,
put a microphone on and go, try a different mic. That sounds good.
Yeah.
That's about the extent of it for me, you know.
Right.
So.
So you record all of galvanized down there?
There was one keyboard noise that Bill did at his house. Oh, yeah. But it was only because he basically was like, hey, what do you think of this? And he sent it to me.
Yeah.
And I'm like, cool. And I just threw it into the session, you know.
You just think, yeah, come here and record it.
Right. Well, he was just like, it wasn't really necessary.
Yeah.
He was like, what do you think of this?
Yeah.
I'm like, I'll put it in there. Yeah. And it was one of those things that's... It's in, out on the fringe. It's just a little noise that comes in and leads into the chorus. It's kind of cool. I'm like, put it in there.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, we did the whole thing there. Vocals, everything.
Nice.
It's
a great album, man.
Thank you. I'm a big fan of it personally. Yeah. I like the songs. I mean, I think I also probably have, since I did all that work on it, feel a connection with it that I don't feel with the other records. But I also feel like we never worked with the right producers. That's not a knock with the producers we worked with. In fact, both of them were very, very cool. I got into it with all three of the producers we worked with. But it wasn't my fault. I'm not saying it was my fault at all. Not at all was any of it my fault. The first guy basically just insulted me to my face, and I walked out, and then he tried to apologize, and I was like, nah, I'm done with you.
Yeah.
I was trying to help Steve, and he told me to quit bothering him, and Steve immediately looks to me for feedback on anything, whether how the performance was, pitch-wise, rhythm-wise, you know, so I was just in there looking at him. He's like, well, what are you doing? You know, I'm probably telling too much of a story there, but no, it wasn't a big deal. Michael Phil Blum is a great guy. He was a cool guy, but I got really mad at him, you know, my feelings were kind of hurt, and I was also 22, 23 years old, whatever, and I kind of stormed out, but then Garth was awesome, and I loved him, but I disagreed with how he dealt with drum tracks and editing drum tracks. And he did too much editing, and so he convinced me to play a certain song. I think I'm getting my songs confused. If it was Going Down or was it My Apology? Both of them, I had a pattern worked out. He told me to change it. I did. I did a take the original way, then I did a take the other way, and I was like, I completely disagree with you. I still think it's better the original way. So then later on that night, he goes, you were right. The original way is better. I'm like, cool. Do we have to do it again? He goes, no, we got the take. We're good. Then all of a sudden I come in to listen after the guys have been putting guitars and basses on everything, and it was like take three. And I went, what is this? You told me, this is the take? This isn't the way I wanted it to go. He goes, well, I was here when we were cutting all the tape and editing drum. I'm like, what the hell? I'm not going to sit here for hours while you guys make menial drum edits. They didn't even need to, they weren't, like they would listen to a take, and I would always do at least two or three. I think we did four for every song on that one. And they go, well, we really like this fill from take two. We're going to cut it in. Whatever. That to me, I wouldn't have even known the difference because all my fills are just sort of off the cuff. And they were just wasting time. And that was before they weren't using Pro Tools. They were cutting tape.
Wow.
You know how time-consuming that is?
Yeah.
So the engineer would just be in the other room just whoop, whoop, cut. I don't have time for that. You know, I got other things I want to do. And anyway, so I got mad at him for that. And then I don't remember the last guy, Cliff, I don't remember necessarily getting mad at. I just it was just sort of like it was kind of weird because – we had flown to L.A. to start making it, and then we had to come back and play a Ho-Ho show for the point, but Steve hadn't finished vocals yet. So he and Steve kind of cut a whole bunch of the vocals without any of us there, and a lot of us weren't really happy with what came back.
Yeah.
Like, they had made a lot of changes that were just clearly, like, executive decisions on his part without running it by us.
Yeah.
That was a little frustrating. But again, he's a great guy. But I just never – I always thought we should have done it ourselves. Or had somebody that just was really like-minded, that totally got where we were coming from to make those decisions. But once I realized how much cheaper it was to do it on your own and that we had the means and the ability to do it on our own, it was a better situation all around,
Sure.
We've all grown up. There was no – see, because a lot of times what a producer tries to do is a little bit like a coach in a lot of ways is tries to push people's buttons to get the best performance out of them and all that kind of work guys against each other because he knows what's best. And I don't always agree that the producer that's not in the band knows what's best for the band. Now, that you should value their opinion.
Yeah.
That's the whole point of having an outside opinion, but, you know.
That was always kind of my question is, you know, it is very important, you know, when bands choose a producer, and I think that's why they put so much focus on it, is to make sure that somebody does have the voice that's going to kind of represent you and not somebody who's just going to come in and be like, okay, here, we recorded this, and then you listen to it and you're like, this is not what we did. So, and I guess, like, so when, in a situation like that, you know, is the band have the ability to kind of just override the producer and say,
for
you
sure.
Know what?
I mean, ultimately, that's the way it should always be. It should be your record, and you should... I think it depends on the producer, and it depends on the if you're on a label, the way that the label presented you with it, and if they tell you that this is the way it's going to be, and you're going to do it. If not, we'll pull the money. Then there's not much you can do about it. And when you get somebody like Rick Rubin or something like that, he's sort of, you know, I don't know what we're looking for, like omniscient almost, you know, like that kind of thing. The funny thing is, everybody I know that's dealt with him says he doesn't do anything.
Yeah.
They're like, he sits on the couch and looks like he's asleep. And then he'll go, that's cool, I like that. That's a good bit. Keep that bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't like that part that much. Let's lose it. Like, that's essentially what he does. And then, and I mean, like, or, but again, now I think that the title of producer, depending on what kind of band you are, is completely different. I was reading the last U2 article, and basically, I think they use several producers, if I remember correctly, or they move, maybe, I'm confused, but they might have moved from producer to producer and settled on the guy where what they did was, a lot of their ideas were sort of disjointed ideas,
yeah,
and they sort of gave it to the, and here you go, and he kind of cut it up and made songs out of it. If you put it in Pro Tools, you go, I'm going to take this verse, I'm going to make it a verse and repeat it four times,
Copy, and then
I'm going to take that chorus part, there's your chorus, and that's the song.
Yeah. Yeah.
The songs weren't necessarily arranged by U2 that way. You had to bring a producer in to sort of clean up your mess, so to speak.
Yeah.
And I guess that's one way to do it.
Yeah, yeah. I
don't think I would ever do it that way.
I kind of feel like that's like just phoning it in almost. I mean, you've done it.
Well, the arrangement of the song is like, well, that's a whole nother, that's probably a whole other podcast too. I feel like the arrangements of songs have become, songs are much more about the way they sound and whatever the hook or whatever it is that you're trying to, and the overall substance of the, like, it can pretty much be one part for 3.5 minutes.
Yeah.
There doesn't even need to be a B section. Don't need a chord change. It's the same riff for chord for 3 minutes, and that's it, you know? And, you know, you got some silly hook or whoa somewhere in there, and then you've got yourself a song.
Yeah.
God, you could never approach music that way, man. No, I've never found music like that compelling to me in any way, shape, or form. Especially when you take, I could find it compelling if it was like a guy with an acoustic guitar singing it to you, and the human element of what he's playing and singing, or she gets it across. But it's all like, it's been quantized, and the drums have been perfected, and the vocals have been auto-tuned. Like, anything that made it compelling to me is just devoid of pop music at this point. And I'm just kind of like, I'll go, yes, that's, I get what you say, that's catchy, yes.
Right.
But sonically and everything that's going on here, this does nothing for me. I would never buy this and listen to it in my car. Like, that's pretty much the way I view, there's very, very, very few things that I just listen to anymore. I can't believe how old I sound.
Well,
but I've officially, like, reached the generational divide. There's no doubt about it, man. I mean, like, when I watch, you know, 40,000 people go to see a DJ, I will never wrap my brain around that.
Yeah.
I just can't. Not saying they're not having fun, good for them, but, like, I don't understand what's compelling about the visual or the show.
I'm only 29, and I feel the same way. So
yeah,
so
yeah,
I'm
a little older than that.
Maybe I'm old now too.
Already, but it really is. It's just I don't know.
Well, it seems like now, and maybe it's just like, it seems like the whole process of like creating music from like the business side of it is so like structured to being like, we have to do it this way, it has to sound like this, and it has to be perfect in this way, and like there's no like that's what kind of made music nice, is that having those little like rougher sounds or things that weren't so perfect and spot on. And I mean, obviously you want to have a good product, but like when it's so completely cleaned up and there's no like,
I think there are several tangents I could go on there. The one I'll start with is, I don't know how many people would ever argue that probably the most successful producer of all time was George Martin, produced all the Beatles stuff.
Yeah.
And he has talked about how he'd work with other people. I might be wrong here, Diana Ross or Dionne Warwick or somebody like that. And he's like, and she was doing a take. He wrote a book. His book's great. And she came in, I said, that was fantastic. And she listened to it. She goes, well, aren't I a little flat right there? And he goes, I don't know. I wasn't actually paying that much attention to how perfect the pitch was. I was listening to the performance, and I was moved, so I'm good with it. It doesn't need to be perfect.
Yeah.
And it's just like, but nowadays, obviously, that goes without saying. I mean, even the crummiest band, where maybe the fact that they're not great players is part of the charm, is that gets erased from the equation.
Yeah. Yeah.
With Pro Tools. And it's like I use Pro Tools, don't get me wrong, but I press record.
Right.
It's in lieu of tape. You know, tape is expensive and time consuming and a headache.
Yeah.
A hard drive is really cheap and easy, and you back it up and you're done. You know, it's like, that's why I use Pro Tools, because it's the only thing I can afford and be able to make records on. But I mean, it hasn't become a modern medium. It's become a tool in and of itself.
Yeah.
And I don't see why music went that way. And a lot of what you're talking about too, I think, was, we talked about that in the 90s. Like when we were on a label and dealing with it, what was funny is, you notice how just everything started to sound the same.
Yeah.
And what would happen was, because, you know, people that work at labels are really smart and they really know a lot about music. Sorry. You can't, I know you don't get sarcasm on a podcast, but they really don't. They're music fans, usually. They're like people that just wanted to get into it and be around music and be around bands. But, it was a lot of lessons we learned, I think, in our years in The Urge. And a lot of it was we were very susceptible and gullible to, did you see what so-and-so did? Well, we need to do that.
Yeah.
Well, what works for somebody else doesn't necessarily work for you. But what would happen in the music world was a band, okay, nobody knew who Butch Vig was when he produced Nirvana's Nevermind. Nobody knew who he was. Suddenly, he was the hottest producer in the world. Yeah. Now, I'm not knocking Butch Vig. He happens to be awesome. There are a whole lot of producers that get production credit on said record and start producing everybody, and I don't think that they're necessarily doing anything special.
Yeah.
They just happen to produce somebody that had a really successful record, you know?
Yeah.
So the theory is, well, this guy produced it. He must have done it. Well, maybe the band was just really good, and the guy said, yeah, I like it.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
It's like, that really could be the extent of it. I'm not saying that that's necessarily the case, but what I am saying is that, so that guy's successful. So then a label goes, we got to find a band that sounds kind of like Nirvana.
Yeah.
They find a band that sounds kind of like Nirvana, and they go, here's the deal. You got to have this guy produce your record because he produced a Nirvana record.
Yeah.
So he produces it, and then they go, you got to get this guy to mix it because he mixes a Nirvana record. And even a step further, they go, you got to get this guy to master it. Before you know it, everybody starts getting bands that sound like another band and then doing it in every link in the chain. Now, if you found a band that was maybe like Nirvana, but you want a completely different route with a producer, he might give it like a different vibe where you go, well, it's kind of like Nirvana, but it's kind of different, too.
Yeah.
It's kind of cool. Instead, everything came out sounding exactly the same, especially specific to said band. Like, if you sounded like that band, then you ended up probably using the same producer and the same mix engineer. So it's like, it's one thing to sign a band that sounds like somebody else because that's hot, you know, and you're trying to find it. But then to just every link in the chain make it sound the same, I'll never wrap my brain around.
Yeah.
I've done a few recordings in the subsequent years, like just one-offs or two-offs with some young guys, like pop guy, oh, I got these songs, will you, record them?
Yeah.
And I wind up playing drums and bass and stuff on them, you know, whatever, filling them up. But, like, he was explaining to me a song that he wanted it to sound like. And I wasn't familiar with the song. And then he played the song for me, and it was essentially the same thing, like the chords. and he basically goes, I want it to sound like that. I go, so you're not only writing the same song, you want it to sonically sound like that. I can't wrap my brain around why anyone would want to do that.
Right.
I understand that you want to be successful like that person and that you like the song, but you go, well, that's my inspiration for it.
Yeah.
But it's not going to sound like that. You know, I mean.
Do you think that's kind of like the divide of like the musicians who really have a passion and probably would work that extra mile to be successful compared to like somebody who's like, I just want to sound like this because I want to be big. You know, like, do you think the bands who don't look at that and say, hey, we want to sound like them are the ones who are going to probably stay a little around longer, even if not necessarily on a successful level, but like, even, you know, are going to continue to do it even.
Well, I mean, yes, I think so, but gosh, in this day and age, who knows what gives anybody any staying power? I mean, like, you could have the band that's. Does anybody really care about, like, Kings of Leon right now? Like, do you hear anything? You couldn't escape those guys five years ago or whatever, and they're still a band, but it's just like, you know what I mean? And I'm not, that's not a knock on them.
No,
that's how fickle we are. And they were like
attention span of like
it's
now,
nobody can wait to hear what you're going to do next. And if the record doesn't like blow people away, it's like, nah, that's all right.
Yeah.
Okay, well, maybe their next record will. Maybe their next record will be awesome.
Yeah,
it's almost like you don't get that chance.
Yeah, right. I mean, there's a lot of bands that kind of had that. They peaked, you know, with the, you know, the big album, but then they've like kind of fell off with the second, third, or whatever albums. But they're still like great albums, just they don't get that radio push that, you know, like I think that's might be where they're at kind of now. Like they could still be putting out good stuff, but they're not being pumped by the radio station as much. And
that's probably true. Or they just kind of lost their band of the moment?
Yeah. Well, I think I think they had some difficult Kings of Leon in particular. I think they had some issues with like.
Dude, they're all. I mean, three brothers and I mean, they're because that's a whole different animal.
Yeah.
I'm using them as an example only because like they were a band that just everybody that I knew was just like these guys are the greatest, and I was like, well, I like this song. I like this song. I don't think they're the greatest.
Yeah.
I'm not knocking them at all. I don't. I just. Like, most of the bands, like, people, like, kind of lose their minds over them. I go, you know.
Yeah.
Like, when I first heard, like, Muse, I was like, oh, my God, this is amazing. But, like, I don't find their newer stuff nearly as ambitious as their early stuff. But it's much more commercial.
Sure.
So how do you knock that? But, I mean, their early stuff was like rock opera, shredtastic, you know, like these guys are unbelievable. It's much more streamlined kind of songwriting. But
I feel like a lot of that, like, they take anything that was like unique and individual about somebody, and then like it finally just kind of gets pressed out to where it's just like it all kind of starts fitting in more of a commercial mold and like.
That's probably true. But to Muse's credit, they still sound like I'll hear them. You still know it's them. Like they have a thing. I'm not knocking them at all. Right. I'm simply saying that like when I first heard them, I was like, whoa, these guys are freaks. Yeah. And they're still freaks, just that they're not writing songs where they're showing off the whole time. Like, but that's kind of what I liked about it. It's like, this is crazy, you know?
I try to keep up with current, you know, pop and, you know, whatever, top 40 stuff. I try to keep up with it a little bit. Just like I read like the back of the Rolling Stone to see what the top songs and albums are selling.
I don't know what they are.
Yeah,
that's the sad thing for me when I look at Rolling Stone. I'm like, I don't know who these people are. I don't know who the artist is, let alone if I ever heard the song.
I try to check them out just to see if I'm missing anything, and usually I'm not. But that's every now and then I'll stumble upon something that's actually worthwhile. But
Especially like that pop stuff though, because it's like I guess like 107.7 or whatever it's on. I'm like, I'd never listen to that station, so I'll never hear this stuff. I hear it playing in Joe Dirt playing in a cover band when we take a break. When we take a break, you know, I'm gonna hear all the, you know, whatever. I'm gonna hear Jesse J and all that kind of stuff. You know, that's the only time I hear it.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
But you know, I think that, you know, and I don't. I hate like singling out people, but no, I'm gonna use that the whole Pharrell song, you know, the lawsuit, and I'm gonna use that as an example, because you know I understand that popular music has been around now for 60 years. It's all been done, like every chord permutation, and you know, every people have hacked up the same riffs, you know, over and over and over again. It's all been done, but there's being inspired by something, and then there's biting, you know what I mean? And I thought that it was the Marvin Gaye song when I heard it. Because it was the same rhythm, like even the little like all the little polyrhythms were the same. And I remember my brain going, because this is how my brain works, I'm like, what's a different key? But that's easy enough to do in a computer nowadays. You can put it in there and change the key without even changing the tempo.
Right.
And I was like, and then he started singing the falsetto. I was like, well, wait a minute, is this not the Marvin? And then as the song kicked in, I'm like, man, that's too close for me, you know.
Yeah.
Now, I understand. He's frustrated. He goes, well, if you don't allow us to be inspired, where do we go from here?
Yeah.
Okay, if you're going to be inspired by it, don't make the sonics of the track the same. Don't put the same, like, groove, drum sound, all that. Make it more bombastic or less bombastic or whatever the case may be. I mean, they just kind of hook, line, and sinker.
Yeah.
I don't care what they do. He made a ton of money anyway. It's not like it's good for him,
right?
You know, but, like, you can't really cry about it, because that's on the nose, man. You can't tell me. Like, there's no way that he could have written that song. And you go, I never even heard that song.
Yeah.
That's just a coincidence. There's no way that's a coincidence, you know. I just telling the story the other day, it's an amazing one. It was Stevie Nicks. This is what I'm talking about, where you can be inspired by something without ripping it off. She talked about how she wrote her song Stand Back. Do you know that song? It's like real synthy. Stand back, whatever. Somebody out there knows this song. The point is, she said, I was in my car, and I was driving, and I heard Little Red Corvette by Prince. And it's the same chord changes, you know. It's F to G to A minor to F. It's the same chord. Songs don't sound anything alike. But it is, that's where she got it from. She's like, I started singing over that, and I liked it, and I went on the piano and started hammering it out. She said, get in the studio to make the track. She goes, and I felt bad. She was like, I wonder if Prince would be cool with knowing that I totally got this from him. Does anybody know how to get in touch with him? So somebody got in touch with Prince and said, we're down here with Stevie Nicks. She's got this song. She said she was inspired by Little Red Corvette. She wants to make sure you're cool with it. He shows up in the studio. He listens to it, and he goes, I like it, but you know what it needs? And the song has this, like, synth bass. She said he sat down, listened to the track, played synth bass to the whole song on the keyboard and went, all right, cool, and left. And she's like, that was my entire interaction with Prince. But that's just a cool story there. But the point being is that the song does not sound like the Prince song.
Right.
She straight up told him, I heard that, I liked it, I got inspired by it. And he went, okay, I can see that, but this is cool. You're doing your own thing with it.
Yeah.
It doesn't sound anything like the song either. Like, the sonics aren't the same. I guess it's somewhat the same keyboard sounds. Everybody had the keyboard sounds in 1982.
Right. Yeah,
you know?
Right, yeah.
But, I mean, it's just like, it just seems to me now, like, I'll hear it all the time. There's a song, and I don't know who it is. and it sounds exactly like the David Bowie song "Young Americans," mm-hmm. and it's the sax, it's the same groove, and it's the saxophone, and it's David Sanborn on the David Bowie song. It sounds like David Sanborn. It's got like the same effect on the saxophone, the same delay of yeah. It's like sounds like a 50s. It's just, you know, the song already sounds like it. Let's put the saxophone in there, play the same licks, and let's even get the same. I don't, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting too. I don't
get that.
I don't think too that there's going to be another like big, I don't know, like big band because of how like short time span people like the bands yeah. last. I don't see another like huge band like, you know, 10, 20 years from now looking at a band like the last band, and I don't know, you know, what you guys think, but like Linkin Park was the last band that had such a huge universal appeal
yeah.
that I could see him as being like a big band, whether they're good or not, whatever.
Right, but no,
like,
that's not the point.
In
yeah,
terms of, like, commercial success, like, I don't see...
Well, I mean, I guess to an extent, like Foo Fighters was kind of... I mean, they did two nights at Wembley, for God's yeah. sake. Yeah. Like, that's insane. But
yeah, I think they're about the only one yeah. right now that could be considered, yeah.
I mean, U2 to an extent, but who knows what's up with Bono. But, I mean, you're also dealing with a band that's been around for 35 years.
Yeah,
you know, I think,
in terms of a band that would come out in the next 5 to 10 years, I don't think has a chance of... And maybe they will, but, like, growing to be that big because I think our attention spans are so just, like...
Like maybe Metallica was after the Black Album. They were, like, yeah. the biggest band in the world.
Right.
They were going everywhere in the world, and everybody knew who Metallica was. Like, that kind of thing. And
yeah.
it's like...
I don't think that even will exist anymore in the music because of how the music industry is, and I think it all...
What seems odd about it, though, is that it's some, like... Like, Muse is big here, but they're just massive in
yeah.
Europe. You know, they're, yeah. like, gods. And it's just, like... They were gods in Europe before anybody knew who they were here, like that kind
yeah.
of thing. So maybe it's a little different. But you're right; it's not like the world over, you
yeah.
know. Like, you know, bands, U2, the Police, even in their brief period, were like huge. They would, you know, play Africa and stuff like that, and
yeah.
it was just they were huge everywhere. It's just it's not like that anymore.
I got this DVD. Stacey's big on Michael Jackson. We bought this DVD of him live in like. I don't know, somewhere in like China or something, whatever, or something.
Japan
or
something.
Yeah, something. I forget which country.
It was like
it was.
Ohio or something.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But
Ohio, China.
I mean, like he's up on the stage and you can't see the back of the crowd. Like there's like
yeah,
like I mean there's millions of people.
So they
like,
can't see him.
Yeah,
that's what's funny
yeah.
about it. They
like I mean, but everybody like just to be there. But like, and then they start like showing people like in the front, and people are just like collapsing and passing out
right.
and stuff. And it's just like
yeah.
And it's just to think, like I've never once had that feeling of to any artist, like to where I'm just gonna be like, oh, you know.
No,
like,
yeah. I mean, the Beatles are those guys for me, but I've seen McCartney twice, and
yeah,
it's weird. It is kind of weird because I started to go, that's it. There he is.
Yeah,
like that's
right.
a little bit weird,
yeah.
but it, yeah, I don't.
I just
really get that.
But I mean, yeah, like to that extreme to have a million people show up to a show or whatever. It, you know, it's just ridiculous. Like if it was.
But I mean, even on like a lesser scale,
yeah.
Have you ever seen that Iron Maiden documentary movie?
Well,
you don't have to like Iron Maiden.
Yeah.
It's one of those that's amazing because it's
yeah.
a story of their tour where they wanted to do, like, what I'm getting at is that they go to, you know, I'm going to miss, I mean, like India and
yeah.
Argentina and Costa Rica, and people are just losing their
yeah.
minds because bands like that. You know, metal, especially metal, though, has that like hardcore, and then they don't get to see them.
Yeah.
yeah.
So, and you know, here they are; they've been around for 35 years or whatever. You know, and people are just losing their minds. But the movie's amazing because
yeah.
it's about how they wanted to do a world tour and it was too expensive, so they got their own jet, and the singer is a pilot, and he
oh, wow.
flew the jet.
Oh, yeah.
So they
heard,
had the entire
yeah.
production and everything on one gigantic jet. It's insane. Oh. It's awesome. But the point being is, it's like it's just you don't have to like the band to watch them go to.
Sure.
Yeah,
the middle, you know, the middle of nowhere. I mean, they were. I'm trying to think of how exotic it was. I'm gonna screw it up, but it's like. I mean, they might have even played like you know, they didn't play Libya, but like Morocco or
yeah.
something like that, and just it's just out of control, and it's.
Yeah.
I mean, that's amazing, man. That's just.
What? I just got Netflix like 2 days ago, so that would give me something to look up on there.
I think it is on there. It's called Flight 666, of course. Yeah.
There's a good one on the Eagles, too.
That one's unbelievable. And I still haven't even seen the whole second half of that one.
See, I've seen like bits and pieces when I think it was on like Showtime or something. But
the story behind them is amazing, yeah. And they're just jerks. Sorry, I don't even feel bad saying that. Like I'm ever going to come across Don Henley. He does not come off like a nice person.
Every once in a while, whenever we talk, like if we say something
yeah.
about like a musician or a comedian, that we're like, well, I guess we won't get thin one, so I guess we have to mark the Eagles off of people who don't get on the podcast.
I mean, it's in the movie. Glenn Frey is talking about how he was threatening Don Felder on stage, and it's, you can hear him. He goes, "I'm going to kick your ass when we get off the stage."
And then didn't he get really? Off the stage and they just jumped in a limo?
He just
Don something.
Felder just took off. I'm not even dealing with this guy. I mean, that's who does that?
Yeah.
You know, in this band with the guy, you're dead when we're done playing.
I think Oasis.
I'm gonna get. Yeah, well, that's different.
That's brotherly love, right there.
I think.
pardon me.
I think Glenn Frey got a writing credit on "Take It Easy," who was written by Jackson Browne. But I think he got a writing credit because he changed one line.
Well, Jackson Browne helped him write it, and apparently, according to the movie. He was stuck, and Jackson Browne, I'm maybe getting the line wrong, but I think he might have given him, "It's a girl, my lord, in a flatbed Ford, slowing down, take a look at me." Yeah. He goes, and I was like, "That's it," you know, like that. So they that's actually really interesting in the movie, though. You got to see that they lived, he and Don Henley lived in the same building with Jackson Browne. And he goes, "That's when I realized how you wrote songs." He goes, "He would wake up in the morning, and we'd hear him down there, and he'd be playing the piano, and be playing, he'd be banging out some chords, and you'd hear him, he'd stop. And we knew that he was writing, writing words, writing the chords out. Then he'd play a little bit more, and he'd write the chords out. And he'd finish the song, and then he'd have lunch, and you'd hear him, and then he'd be writing another one. Like, they were like, he just was a dedicated writer. It's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
And that's when they're like, "Oh, that's what we have to do," because they were Linda Ronstadt's backing band.
Huh.
And they wanted to kind of go out on their own, but they're like, "We had a good gig. That was a great gig. Like, we were making bank, and we were playing with Linda Ronstadt, and she was awesome, and she loved us, but we really wanted to write our own songs, you know, so... It's pretty. It's a really good movie. It's great.
There's those documentaries. Like, anytime it's kind of, you get to see a little more than just a live band. Like, they're so incredible.
Well, I mean, people either love or hate Rush, but the Rush documentary is amazing. I love Rush. They're one of my favorite bands. But it's fascinating, man. It's just a great to just see them start at the beginning and then how they come together. It's just, you know, the happenstance of that. The Sound City movie. Have you seen that one? It's Dave Grohl. Did the movie, and it was about Sound City, which is where they made Nevermind, and it closed. But they also, it started out as a dorky, wonky movie because it had a really amazing, sought-after recording board, you know, recording console that he basically ended up buying it from the guy and putting it in his studio. So he was like, "I was going to tell the story of the board, but then I just realized how the story of how this amazing studio died."
Yeah.
And that's where we're at, was what was interesting. But, I mean, the studio is basically responsible for Fleetwood Mac. It's just, it's crazy how it happened. You know, Buckingham and Nick were recording there. Fleetwood Mac was going through a bunch of changes. He was looking for a studio to record in. He walked in. They were listening back to a playback, and he was like, "Well, what's that?" And I'm like, "Well, this is these guys." And he was, listening to them. "This is awesome." Yeah. And about a week later, he was talking to somebody. He goes, "Hey, that stuff I was listening to with that guitar player, we're looking for a guitar player." And they go, "Well, yeah, he's available, but here's the problem. You won't just get him. You're going to have to take his girlfriend. They're a package deal." And he's going, "Well, I already had Christine McVie. I already had a girl voice, a keyboard player. I didn't need another one." He goes, "But I took them both." And that was, I mean, they're one of the most successful bands of all. I mean, it's awesome. The movie's well worth watching for that, but it's...
Yeah.
Those movies are always great to me, man. I'll watch ones where I'm like, "I don't want to watch this."
Yeah.
And then I watch it and it's still pretty cool.
Well, don't have to be the fan of the band necessarily.
No.
Just because they're interesting. I think I watched one in Quiet Riot that was
I would love to see that.
It was the drummer, I guess, trying to get, you know, the band back and hiring a singer and stuff. That was an interesting one too. And
he's never let it go.
Well, that's what they talked about too, how, you know, it's
Frankie. I actually met him, and there's the old singer who's now gone, Kevin DeBrow. Jerry and I did. We were on the road. The Urge was on the road. I forgot where we were. I think it was Cincinnati or something. And we had a day off. We got in the evening and pulled up to our hotel, and there was another bus there. Hmm. And we're like, "I wonder who that is." And somebody's like, "It's Quiet Riot." I'm like, "Quiet Riot? No kidding." So Jerry and I go down to Wendy's, and those two are in line right in front of us. I was like, "No way, that's Frankie Vanelli and Kevin DeBrow." And we were like, "Hey, man, what's up?" And they were kind of like, yeah. We're like, "Hey, we're in a band." And they're like, "Yeah, that's great." So they could not have been more dismissive.
Like, "We don't care. Just leave us alone."
And we were looking at each other like, "We probably put more people in the room than you did, you know?"
Right. Yeah.
No, that's – I don't care. I totally respect Charlie – our Frankie Vanelli. He's just – he tries to keep it going, man. You know, he can't – can't knock the guy. I mean, he's always trying to get it. Yeah, he's very passionate about it. And I think that's okay, man. That's good, you know. But I would love to see that one.
It's really cool, and I feel bad because one of the guys they hired, I guess, is, you know, is shown performing, and he forgets, like, the chorus or something. It's Come On Feel the Noise, right? And they're like,
that's the one he forgets.
This is the one that you, this is what everybody comes to hear. This is the one song you should know, and you mess up, like,
yeah,
I
right.
think he forgets one of the verses or, you know, whatever.
Well, they're really compelling verses.
Yeah.
So you'd say, I got an evil mind. I'll tell you, honey. Yeah. I don't know why. Although they didn't write those lyrics. That's a Slade song. So
yeah.
They can't take credit for that ridiculousness, but, you know.
Yeah. It's interesting. I felt real bad for the guy.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
He was like a painter or something, and he got brought on to, you know, play this, and yeah, he like I think they ended up firing him because it happened like two or three times. Like,
are you good at painting? Good. Good.
Come on and
stick with it.
Yeah.
Stick with it.
Keep on going.
You're gonna need that gig.
Yeah.
We were talking about putting Fleetwood Mac together, and I mean, it's totally different.
But
I'm not really a fan, but I find it amazing though that like One Direction, all those guys all were like failed on X Factor, and then Simon put them together as that group, and now they're like, you know, one of the most successful, you know, selling things. Like, I mean, it's just crazy.
They look right. You only got to be able to sing a little bit. You don't have to be a great singer. But you know, especially if there's five voices, sure. They can sing pretty good.
Yeah,
you got good songwriters.
Right.
It's just kind of crazy that you know you take five normal kids and put them together, and you got the biggest band in the world right now for teenage girls. And it's
that's what's so funny though, is how that is. It's like a different animal altogether. It's just entertainment.
Yeah.
It's just giving, literally handing the people what they want. You know?
I listened to Stern, and he played a game on the show the other day.
I wish I had that. God, I don't have it on XM.
He's been putting out some of the best radio in his career.
Oh, I know. It's great. Every time I hear it, it's awesome.
But he played a game on his show the other day after Zayn left One Direction.
I heard all about it.
He played a game of whether this girl's reaction was to a Zayn leaving the band or like a major event.
Yeah, right.
And,
yeah.
And like so, they were playing. Like Robin was trying to guess like which one it was, and like. And like, no, that was a girl hearing about, or that was a girl having childbirth.
Yeah, right.
And like, or something like, you know,
right.
Stuff like
blood curdling scream. Yeah,
that's hilarious.
So it was really a funny bit. Yeah.
And of course, Zayn, what a great name.
They always got to have those. I mean, it's funny because it's Corey, every 2 years. It's New Kids on the Block, and probably before the New Kids on the Block, and then NSYNC, and you know, I mean, that whole boy band phenomenon in like late '90s or whatever. And it's just funny how it keeps coming back, even despite people like. And I guess it's just because you get a whole new generation of girls. Like,
oh my god!
Well, I'll never forget. Like in the early '90s, the wearing New Kids on the Block, ironically, was like when Jerry and I, our band before we were in the Urge, we were in this band called Life Without Wayne, which we used to open for the Urge all the time, and we would just all wear like all New Kids on like shirts and hats and pins, and it was just like to ironically make fun of them, you know. And looking back, it's like you were giving them, that's too much credence to give them. They're not even supposed to be in the discussion, you know.
Yeah.
They just had Donnie Wahlberg on Stern the other day too, so like that was
Donnie. Yeah,
they're kind of crazy how
they're out touring.
Yeah, they're
doing a tour.
TLC and Nelly, is that them?
Well, maybe Nelly. Who knows if we'll be there? But
you mean
TC?
L's.
Yeah.
There's
rest
no
in peace, pour one out for
L's. Kind of gone. No, I don't mean that to be mean. I'm just like, it's kind of weird when they're called TLC and one of them.
And Nelly just got in trouble, so who knows?
Yeah,
you can't really. It's like the Beastie couple of guys, you know, like you can't do it without one of them, can you?
They said they're done.
That can't be done. That's just awful.
Yeah,
you want to talk about feeling old? One of the Beastie Boys is dead. I mean, that's just crazy. That's just a crazy thought. I mean,
well, and Adam, he's an actor now, so he's
he was on The Daily Show last night. He was hysterical.
Yeah,
he was killing me. He was so, because they don't. I thought for sure, I'm like, Jon Stewart, love. He's mentioned him many times. Yeah. They've met. They'd never met.
Oh wow.
And it was great. You got now I'm gonna go off on a tangent, but you gotta see it, because he goes, "Can I sit in your chair?" And he comes over and he goes, "I like this." Yeah, he goes, you know, politics and jokes and stuff. You know, it was great. He's hysterical.
I
love it. Yeah, I good for him, man.
Yeah,
I want to see him act.
Who was it on? I think he was on Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon, and they were telling a story about I guess one of their first breaks was going on the road opening for Madonna.
That's right. Yeah,
and like they said, they got like, you know, people were like booing.
Oh, of course,
and, like,
yeah.
But it was just kind of crazy that Madonna gave him a break and put him out on his massive tour.
That was when they were like ridiculously crass, yeah. and just coming out and squirting beer on everybody, yeah. and just like, you know, like a bunch of frat boys, you know, drunken frat boys. It's hysterical. But yeah, it's, I mean.
Yeah, I'm bummed that I never got to see them live.
I actually saw them at Mississippi Nights. Oh, it was pretty awesome. I guess it would have been the Check Your Head tour. It was freaking amazing. Huh. Amazing. And then just the energy in a show. They were playing a lot of live music at that time, too. They started playing their instruments. So about half the show was them actually playing.
Yeah.
And on top of... And even when they weren't playing, they had, like, the keyboard guy, Money Mark, would be kicking it on the songs. It was it was pretty killer. But it was weird because Jon Stewart asked him something about making music, and he goes, yeah, no, I can't. Like, he could see him about to get emotional. He's like, I can't. I just can't.
Yeah.
I don't have anything to...
Yeah. That's a shame, man.
Like, that's a three-piece unit, man. It's just, oh, man, it's a shame.
Yeah.
And especially, I mean, I would hope Mike D goes on to produce or something, because he could totally be a producer, you know?
Yeah.
I guess Adam wants to act. That's awesome. That'd be fun, I'm sure, you know. But, yeah. But I just can't, the fact that either one of them aren't doing anything is just, sucks, you know.
Yeah, they're such a staple, and I think, Donnie Wahlberg, you say he was on, have you ever watched Band of Brothers? Did you ever see that?
Oh, yeah.
He was, Donnie Wahlberg, I think he was in that. He was pretty good. The whole show was just amazing. But, like, just...
Oh, yeah, he was on Band of Brothers, yeah.
I don't know, but, yeah, it's just, like, when you see people cross over to the different spectrums and stuff, when they do it well, awesome, but when they don't...
I made a joke the other day, because Ludacris just put out a new album, and, you know, and he's been in all those Fast and Furious movies.
Yeah, that's right,
and, so I'm like...
All seven of them?
Yeah. So I'm like, I made the joke, like, you know, he's a pretty good rapper for an actor.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. Well, that's why he had a thing in Rolling Stone about how he's like, I'm still rapping, and I'm still better than everybody else, and all the like all rappers do.
Yeah,
I'm still gonna smoke everybody. I'm like, I think everything's an athletic competition in rap. You know, it's like I'm better, quantifiably so.
Yeah.
The funniest one for me is that that Ice-T plays a cop now. Like after writing Cop Killer and stuff like that, he's now on TV and. LL Cool J, he's, you know, hosting Lip Sync Battle, and...
Yeah, you gotta, Ice-T playing, and, you know, I mean, you gotta, is the irony lost on those guys? I'm not really sure. Although I am anxious to see that NWA movie that's gonna be awesome.
Is that the Compton, straight out of Compton?
I think they're just calling it straight out of Compton, very clever, but, you know.
That's gonna be, I mean, those guys look the part so well, like, they really, I mean...
Well, is it Cube's kid that's in it? Or
I don't know. There was talk about having one of Easy's.
Well, that's what they said. They didn't pick him, and they said it's ridiculous because he looks exactly like him.
Guy playing Easy looks just like Easy.
Does he? Okay, that's good. Yeah.
I mean, he's
kind of the key to that story.
Yeah, sure.
He's the most compelling star. Not that the other guys are more talented than him.
Yeah.
That's what makes him the most compelling part of that story, man.
Yeah, it's got what's his name now? Paul Giamatti.
I saw him and I'm like, whoa,
he's like the record producer.
Sure, sure. Well, you know what's funny about that is those guys kind of created the mold for the way like the rap group thing worked, even all the way through Nelly.
Yeah.
You know, Nelly, the Lunatics were picked up, and the way they do it is they go, we're going to pick one of you guys, give you a solo record, and it's going to put the band on the map. That's why Easy got the solo. Easy was the least talented like rapper out of that crew, but he's Eazy-E, I guess he had like the marketability, whatever. They gave him the solo record while it pretty much came out right at the same time that Straight Outta Compton came out, I think. And if not, they're incredibly close.
Yeah.
Same with like Nelly's record and the first Lunatics record, but it's like Nelly's the one that blew up, and it's like, well, he's part of this crew. It's like that's not the way it goes. Sure. Luckily, the NWA record was better than the Eazy record, but still. It's still Dre working on all the tracks.
Right,
It was just Easy being the main guy. It's just, but I mean, that like the Wu-Tang Clan did it. You know, those guys, Method Man and Red Man, would do their own record.
Yeah.
They'd do that, but they had like 13 guys in the crew. I still don't know how that works.
Yeah.
How do those guys make that
Everybody work? Gets like a word or two per, you know.
They really do. It's insane. It's That's absolutely crazy. Insane.
Well, you're how many bands do you play in? Because like it blows my mind like having two younger kids too. Like how I have two kids and like managing a week podcast. Like I'm terrible at it. I can't imagine
I mean, it is like before I left today, I was helping get the kids ready and give them a bath, and they go to bed. Luckily, they go to bed early because my oldest is in kindergarten, so he's in school every day, so he's got to go to bed. So. I don't know, man. It's just good. Because it's unfortunately what I do.
But I'll say that's a good thing.
Like I said, the problem with it is that it's just not paying what it used to pay. But
yeah.
but basically full time I really only one band, I guess. It seems like, you know, El Monstero and Celebration Day, which is the Led Zeppelin tribute, happen twice a year, basically, give or take. Yeah. I mean, and then the Urge happens when we can do it.
Yeah.
And then, theoretically, Joe Dirt, the cover band, plays pretty much every weekend I'm available. But, you know, like, I only play... I'm off this whole weekend. I have a gig.
Awesome.
Next weekend, I only play Friday. You know, well, it's not, though. That's what I'm saying. Yeah, like, it's great.
Yeah.
It's great, but it's like it used to be, you know. I mean, I used to play pretty much Thursday, Friday, Saturday. We were doing it every Thursday gig, and that was before I had kids.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like now I play less and make less and have way more on the expense side of things. So it's difficult. So basically the Urge, you know, the Joe Dirt, Celebration Day, El Monstero, and then Jerry Jost and I have recently started doing acoustic shows together again.
Yeah.
So we're going to try to dot the landscape with those just to make a little extra money. But I still have to find something else to do on top of all that.
Have you thought about, like, because I know, I think Shane mentioned to me that you've recorded, like, you know, done some recordings with bands. Is that something you'd be ever
I can do it. The problem with that is because it's not my full-time gig, you're now dealing with an entire band of people and me that have to work around not only my schedule, but my schedule where my home and studio are available.
Yeah.
It gets really tricky.
Yeah.
So, I've talked to at least three different, like, people that I know or bands that I know that are like, well, we just want to come in and do three songs, or we want to do a quick three song demo, or my brother-in-law's band wants to, like, just play live and record it, you know. We just haven't hammered it out, you know.
Right.
Nobody has hammered out when we're going to do that.
Yeah.
But, yeah, and that would be nice. The only problem with that is that I'll never charge that much because I have to undercut what a regular studio would, because you've got the amenities at a regular studio and the overhead at a regular studio. I have to go, well, I don't have any of that, so I can't really charge people for that. So it's really a lot of work for not a lot of money. Now, the lucky thing there is I pretty much have all the gear I need. So I'm not one of those people that has to keep buying studio gear to stay up. I'm fine. I can make any rock band work with what I've got, so that's what's cool. But, yeah, I am hoping to do maybe more of that. The other problem I have right now is the Urge. We're not really sure what we're doing. We're sort of – I know Bill mentioned this. We're sort of half writing, half talking about recording covers.
Yeah.
So the problem with that is I kind of want to leave the studio ready to be used when it needs to be used. Whenever – you know, if Carl's available, I go, you come over, we're gonna do drums and bass, and we're going to knock it out, you know. But if I have another band in there with drums set up and a microphone set up and everything, the studio's a small 15 by 20 room. I don't have room to set up two kits and record another, like, that's it.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like I'm afraid to take on a big project because I don't want it to interfere. Because really the whole reason I wanted to build the studio was for me as much as anything else.
Yeah.
I didn't intend to open a business. I don't have an LLC or anything like that. It's just all part of my self-employment.
Sure.
Like, anything I make studio-wise just goes under the same tax umbrella as, you know, me getting paid. So if I were to open it up as a legit business, I could probably certainly do a lot more, even if somebody just said they needed a track mixed, something like that. I mean, I just did that with Kevin Gagnepain, who's Joe Dirt and El Monstero, and he kind of recorded this record for this girl who's actually been in the El Monstero show as one of the performers before. But she did, like, an acoustic record. And he was like, Jesse. And he's like, will you mix it? There wasn't much mixing involved. It's acoustic guitar and vocals.
Yeah. Oh, right.
Sometimes two acoustic guitars, sometimes a backing vocal. But it was just a matter of compiling it and putting it together. We just did it in two nights.
Yeah.
You know? So that kind of – I'll always do stuff like that. But it's just not like – not that anybody needs to know my financial, but I need like a revenue stream. I need a job where it's like everything I seem to be doing right now is pretty fragmented. So it's like I'll look at my month and go, oh boy, I don't have much this month. Next month will be good. That kind of thing.
Yeah,
you know? So like the Urge is doing a weekend next month, so that'll be nice. It's not going to be a lot of money, but it'll be.
Well, it's
better than a Joe Dirt weekend. So
May 8th in Springfield and May 9th in Lawrence, Kansas.
That's correct. Yeah.
So that's a. We're talking a little bit with Bill about that, but you guys haven't hit some of those spots in a while.
Well, I listened to Bill's sleeve. We haven't been to Lawrence in a long time. Yeah. We did play Kansas City last year with 311, and that's only about 40 minutes away, so it's not like it's out of 45 minutes away. But
and you guys, you did Springfield last year, right?
We did. We did. We did Springfield
Rolla and what? St. Patrick's Day or something.
We just did Rolla on St. Patrick's Day. That was a good time. But we did Did we just play Springfield last year? We did make a weekend out of it. I don't recall now.
Yeah, I think
did we just do Springfield? Like, I can't remember. But yeah, but we played the theater, which is the same theater that, that El Monstero played. So that's, like I said, that's the weird thing about El Monstero is essentially it happens when we do our Christmas shows.
Right.
And then we've been adding a summer show. But the last couple of years, we've also just done Springfield in Kansas City. But it's kind of the same. I don't really consider it's like right after we do the winter shows, like 2 weeks later. So it's kind of the same.
Sure.
Oh, well, we're already all rehearsed.
Yeah.
We got all the gear packed together. Let's just take it on the road for a couple of shows. It's just it's too difficult to take on the road. It's just not lucrative, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, the expenses on that show and the overhead are so out of control. It's hard to even fathom like how much we spend.
It's an incredible show, though, man. It's
it's worth it. I mean, like I know you just did this with Bill, but seriously, if you've never seen it, you should see it. And I was not. I mean, I will admit, I've told people this, so I'm not ashamed to say it. I wasn't a Pink Floyd fan before I started doing it.
Yeah.
I hope that doesn't seem like, well, I don't want to watch a guy that I totally am into it now. Like I get into everything that I'm playing. I just, when I was younger, it was like, you know, Van Halen and Rush and Led Zeppelin. When I was really young, like I liked energetic rock, and that was slow, like stoner rock, and it just wasn't my thing.
Yeah,
obviously, when you mature, I hated Neil Young when I was a kid. I love Neil Young now. Like you get older and you go, oh, I get that now. You know, like that kind of thing. And Floyd's the same way. And a lot of it was when I was asked to do it. I was like, I got a lot of work to do. And I'll never forget. I was like, it was in the fall. So I was like, I don't know, raking leaves or what I was doing, just with the phones on, and listening to those songs and like headphones. It's kind of like, oh, there's an awful lot of coolness going on here. You know, it's like, there's a lot more to it than I dismissed when I was a kid. You know,
I need to listen. Like, going to as many El Monstero shows I've been to now. I've been to a couple. But like you guys play some deeper cuts that I'm not familiar with, and a lot of my favorites are pretty much from Wish You Were Here, Dark Side, and The Wall, and I don't really know much from the rest of the record.
When I started doing it, that was all we played.
Yeah.
I mean, we played a large majority of The Wall, Dark Side from start to finish, and a few of the songs, you know, everything off of Wish You Were Here, except for the second half of Shine On Your Crazy Diamond, which is just 10 more minutes of the same stuff. You know, they just bookended it on the record. But so we basically do all of that record, all of Dark Side, and almost all of The Wall. That was the show.
Yeah.
Then we started like, well, you know, a lot of people like Animals. Let's put some stuff from Animals in there. Then we started going even earlier. And now it's just to the point where we've been doing it so long, we're throwing those in just to give people, the same people come to see the show.
Yeah.
We got to give them something different. That's really what it's... And like the Led Zeppelin thing is the same way. The problem with the Led Zeppelin thing is, we now have learned so many songs that everybody likes that we can't fit them in a show.
Yeah.
We just can't. We can't even get close.
Yeah.
Like, it's... We played... I think it was the year... Was it last year? The year before last? It was 2014. And the one night... And maybe it was 2013. The one night... Basically, we go on right around 8. Mm-hmm. And the pageant has a curfew of 11:30 and the strict curfew, like, 11:45.
Because
they have to be out the door by midnight. Yeah. So that if you're not off by 11:45, that gives them 15 minutes to get... You know, 2,000 people or however many are there, 1,500 to 2,000 people out of the room. So we'd played 34 songs, and I mean it was we went on at like 8:05 and got off the stage at 11:45. I mean it was over three and a half hours, and it was just like it didn't feel like it when you're doing it because I like all the songs and I'm enjoying myself. But I was like, first of all, these people are gonna fall asleep, and second of all, we got to wrap it up. So luckily, when we do two nights, we can, you know, we can do different set lists.
Yeah.
The El Monstero show is like a play. You can't really change the set list from night to night. Everything is marked.
Structured
like that show is, we will start here, we will go here, it will be over at this time, we will take a 15-minute intermission.
Yeah.
It's got to be that way. There's there are too many people that aren't on, the actual musicians, that have to do a specific job, that you can't just throw them for a loop. You know, on the Zeppelin show, we look at each other and go like, let's just scratch it, we're running out of time, move on.
Cool.
Okay, fine. Just tell the light, you know, the light guy will figure it out. Oh, they're not doing that one, I guess.
Yeah.
They're going to the next one on the list. You just cannot do that with the El Monstero show. And
we've
never really done it, ever. Like, when we've done it, it's like everybody's heads are going to explode. It's just it's just really weird. That thing is what it is, so we have to try to make it different, and it's really difficult to do.
Yeah.
So we've done certain things like... But I don't know that it went over. Like, last year when we did the summer show at Art Hill, I mean, it was daylight when we started.
Mm-hmm.
And 90% of that show is the visual of it, the lights and all that. So we're like, well, how are we going to make this cool? And we thought, well, in order to make it cool, the stuff that, like, the dark side, some of the wall stuff, we really have to have the light show for that. What can we get by with? Well, we'll start with all the animal stuff. And I'm like, okay, but for the people that don't really know it, that's a pretty weak way to come out, you know? Right. And I don't think it was. I mean, it sounds like I'm dogging our own show. I'm just saying that if that was the decision we had to make based on all that goes into putting that show on. Because, I mean, if we did, we're not going to do Dark Side of the Moon in the daylight. You know, that would,
right,
that
it's
would
almost as
defeat
much as the
purpose.
Environment
yeah,
is.
Right. So, and I mean, our light, our staging and lighting was completely out of control for that show. but the only problem with it was that the way it was on that lawn, it didn't like arc out like an amphitheater. It was just completely spread. So, I mean, there were people that were, if I'm in the middle of the stage, that were, you know, 100 yards that, you know, to the left or right of the stage that couldn't even see me back there, you know, that kind of thing. So it's like, you got to kind of, we should have sort of amphitheatered it maybe a little bit more, but I know like we had things going on these side stages. And when I mentioned it to my family, was over like what would be stage left. And I go, well, it was that little bus that came on. We didn't see that. They weren't even aware of anything that was going on that side of the stage. So it's just nuts. The amount of that show had, I think there were like 50 performers that weren't in the band that were involved in that show in some way or another, whether they were just walking on stilts or they came out and, you know, blew bubbles or whatever it was they were doing. Like, I don't even really know what went down. It was just like, oh man, it's out of control. It's so out of control. Yeah. And it was the hottest day of the year. It was like 105 degrees. It was just, oh man. But it was 13,000 people, man. It was awesome.
Not a bad.
It was awesome.
You'll make the sacrifice. I mean,
it was neat. I doubt we would do that again. Yeah. Like, we've talked about this, and if anybody, I mean, it's hard because I know people that probably go to those shows and want to complain about stuff like that, but it's very difficult to put on a big show like that at a place that isn't a venue, where you don't have any of the infrastructure necessary to put on a show. There was no security. There was no barricades. There were no bathrooms. There was no vending. There was no stage. There was no lights. There was no power. Yeah. I mean, you had to bring every single aspect of it in. So, which is why I say if we do whatever Verizon's called this week, Riverport. I'm going to call it Riverport. Yeah. Mama called it Riverport. I'm going to call it Riverport. But I'm still going to call it Riverport. But, like, you know, yes, people complain about the getting in and out, and it does kind of suck, but there's a parking lot, and there's bathrooms, and there's vending stations, and there's a stage, and awesome dressing rooms, and showers, and like it's just, it's all there.
It's
all you have to do is plan the show. Kevin is a mastermind of that stuff. Like, the stuff he comes up with, and he keeps reinventing himself. It's amazing. But he has to spend so much time on the logistics of a show like that. It's just like, I don't really, I wouldn't want to do it. I'll stick with this. Swinging my arms, playing the drums, man. That kind of stuff gets away from me a little bit. I mean, I'm a little more responsible for the stuff for Celebration Day, but that's kind of taken care of itself at this point, you know?
Yeah.
Everybody knows their role, and we kind of got that thing down to a science, so.
Awesome.
Which, that's worth seeing, too, if you like Led Zeppelin at all. Even if you don't, you should see it.
Yeah.
It's pretty fun.
Yeah, I haven't been able to make one of those yet. They're on my radar.
We don't go crazy stage show wise. It's old school. We keep it old school. It's all like old can lights, and you know.
We had Jimmy on the show, and that's what he said that it kind of compared El Monster to like a Cirque du Soleil kind of show.
Yes. Yeah.
And he said, the quote was that for Led Zeppelin Celebration Day tribute, he's it's like punching your way out of a bag on fire or something like that.
he's always got great analogies.
It's like,
just
a stack of Marshalls and crank them up.
He's loud as hell on that show. It sounds amazing. Like, the guitar sounds that come up. I mean, everything. The guy that runs sound, he's the house guy at the pageant, Randy Knowles. But, I mean, he crushes it. And I don't know what it sounds like out front.
Yeah.
And I always wind up seeing somebody's iPhone video. But somewhere along the line, some of the, whether it's the iPhone or the, you know, whatever, the Samsung or what, somebody's got one that sounds good. Because there are some videos I saw from this year of people like down on the floor, and it sounds amazing.
Yeah.
Like, I can actually hear the mix, and I was like, wow. I told Randy, I'm like, man, you killed it. It's and everybody's like, oh, it's loud, and it's just Zeppelin, and it's in your face. And,
right.
And the bass player's Cubby from Dr. Zhivegas, who's just insane. Like, he's just, like, he's amazing. Amazing bass player. And then Dave Grelli on keyboards, who's plays in the Incurables with Jimmy, but he's got his band The Feed.
Yeah.
He plays with all kinds of people, but he's just a monster player.
started the show with that Funky Butt.
So, he plays with Funky Butt.
Yeah, he set in with Funky
when he
Butt.
Can.
Yeah,
he's basically in Funky Butt, but he's so busy he doesn't play all the time.
Sure,
you know,
yeah.
But yeah, he's a monster player, and it's just because we couldn't like keep it real. We had to go with five guys because we were trying to find a guy that's an amazing keyboard player and an amazing bass player, and like, how are we going to find that guy? And then not to mention, the more I thought about it, I was like, well, first things first, we need an amazing bass player. That's more important than anything else. But then it was like, when they did it live and he would like do key bass, it kind of sounded pretty terrible. Like, there are a lot of songs where there's a bass guitar and keyboards. I'm like, we'll look real enough. Nobody cares that there's a fifth guy there. Let's just make it sound. You know, I'm much more interested in it sounding good. But I mean, we don't look like anything like Pink Floyd when we play.
Sure.
It's just more about presenting the song the right way.
Right.
The first 5 years I did it, there was only one keyboard player. This guy, you know, Darren Pierce. And then when he decided to leave, we brought Bill in, and it was a little bit of a daunting task to jump into months out, so we asked Darren to come back and kind of split the duties a little bit and help Bill out, and they did it together. And then we got Jake, you know, who you've also had a podcast with, and then they do it together. I don't know how we did it with one keyboard player.
Right.
I mean, there are parts where there's a full organ part and a full piano part.
Yeah.
I mean, he must have just been doing like half of each, you know, with one left hand and right hand. I don't really remember. That's amazing because I'm such a stickler for that stuff, but... I don't really remember how he did it. He pulled it off, but yeah, I mean, we eventually were like, let's just get two keyboard players and do this right. Because we will sit there and listen to a song and go, that right there. We're not doing that. Somebody's got to do that bit there. You know, we got three possible guitar players here. Somebody can do it. That kind of thing. So.
Good stuff. Well, we're about out of time,
right?
And I feel like we could probably talk for like another 2 hours.
Of course,
so
I could.
I think we're gonna have to have you back on sometime. And
I would gladly do it.
We're gonna do it when the Blues win the Stanley Cup. We're gonna come on here.
Is that this year?
Yeah, this is this year, and we'll both be probably sobbing and crying out of joy. You know,
I would be. we must say that this is unfortunately after Game 3 of the Wild Series, where they were god awful.
Yeah.
But that series is not over.
That's
I don't know
when
why people are already worried about who they're gonna.
Yeah.
Stand out of town on a rail and all that. I'm like, let's wait till they actually lose the series.
Yeah, so we'll have you back on with them in the cup, and we'll be celebrating.
If they win tomorrow, they might win the cup this year. I still think it's a pretty darn good team. So.
That'd be awesome. Well, man, thanks for coming on. And
thanks for having me, guys. Chris,
blast, and, like, just interesting, just hearing you chat about it.
Run my mouth. Yeah, all right. That's what I do. Well,
no,
you would need another 2 hours for me to get all these ideas.
I hope to have you just to talk more and just kind of pick your brain.
For sure, I'll do it again. Absolutely, I'd love to.
That's fun.
We'd like to throw a track on a lot of times. Do you have a track from Galvanized you prefer to play?
As like the bumper music kind of thing?
Well, we just throw them on the end, just to plug the...
My personal favorite on there is Standing in Line.
Standing in Line. All right, there you go.
Stay
tuned after the show for that. Pick up a...
That hot track.
Yeah, pick up a copy of Galvanized at theurge.net.
Yes.
We're
downloaded at iTunes.
Yeah,
either one.
You
should get the physical copy. It's pretty cool. The artwork's pretty awesome.
Yeah. And you got any date with Jerry?
Plugs? Yeah. I wish I did. I wish I could plug an acoustic date with Jerry. We don't have anything on the books just yet.
Or Joe Dirt.
And we don't have a special name for it. It'll say John Pizzoni and Jerry Jost, or Jerry Jost and John Pizzoni. Whoever wants the Lennon McCartney argument there. We just play random. All over the map, you know, lots of Beatles, but yet we also play like the Police and Van Halen and Morrissey. I mean, we are all over the place. U2 and REM and the Pretenders, and I mean, it's just all over the place.
Nice.
It's pretty crazy, so it's a lot of fun.
Cool.
So,
right.
Thanks for having me, fellas.
Yeah, that was a blast.
Absolutely.
Episode 63, John Pizzoni. That's a wrap. We'll be right back.
Rock, 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 rock,